Laura Kelly is promising that if she's elected governor of Kansas, that she'll have a bipartisan administration. She made that pledge the other day at a debate in Wichita. We'll ask the Democratic candidate what that means and the changes that she wants to make to the state in the wake of former Governor Sam Brownback's tumultuous administration. Laura Kelly has served in the state Senate since 2005. She fought to repeal the Brownback tax plan, and she's been an advocate for more funding for public education. And once upon a time, she headed the Kansas Recreation and Park Association. Laura Kelly joins me here in the studio. Welcome. So good to have you back.
So good to be here, Steve.
And I should point out that I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, and we've endorsed the senator for election here. I'll ask you the same question I asked Senator Claire McCaskill not long ago. In a race that's this close and one that's been going on for so many months, how do you handle the tension of it all?
Oh, I knew what I was getting into, Steve. I've had tough campaigns before when I was running for the Senate. So I anticipated all of this. I'm also married to a sleep doctor, though, so I make sure I get my 8 hours, and that helps. I also have a terrific team. I have a great group of young folks who are leading this team and have done just a great job over the last few months, and they take a lot of the pressure off of me.
So maybe we need to pass a state law that says you need 8 hours of sleep every single night, Senator. Is that where we're going here?
I think that my husband would be delighted
if I were able
to get that done.
You know, one thing that has struck me about your candidacy from the start is that your friends have said that you were genuinely reluctant to get into the race. Why is that?
Well, Steve, I've been asked for a number of years to run for governor. I thought back in 2014 we had an excellent candidate in Paul Davis, and he nearly pulled it off. I was more concerned this year that we did not have a candidate who could get through both the primary and the general. So even though it wasn't something I had anticipated doing, I felt a real need to do it because the thought of Kris Kobach being the governor of Kansas was just too much for me to bear.
What makes you so uncomfortable about that idea? What would a Kobach administration mean for the state of Kansas?
Well, Kansas is in a very fragile situation right now, coming off the 8 years of the Brownback administration, that disastrous tax experiment that really tanked our state in so many ways, our schools, our roads, our healthcare, our economy. And Kris Kobach has pledged to return us to that time and maybe even go further. We can't withstand that. You know, the only way we were able to balance the budget the last 6 years was by robbing every piggy bank we've got. You know, the Bank of KDOT, Department
right.
of Transportation. We took money from CAPERS. We took money out of an investment pool.
Just to balance the state budget.
Just to balance the state budget. You know, we got rid of things like the Bioscience Authority, the Arts Commission. You can just go on and on and see what we've taken away from this state. We need to bring things back. We need to put things back together. Kris Kobach would be a complete and total disaster just from a fiscal point of view. But then I also look at a reputational point of view. You know, Kansas is suffering a real reputation deficit right now, and we need to restore that. We need to make Kansas what it was when my husband and I came here 32 years ago, a wonderful place to raise your family, to have a job, to great quality of life, and seen as a very moderate, pragmatic place that's full of common sense. And I think that's where we need to get back to. And I think Kris Kobach would not benefit our state reputationally.
You know, he was sitting in the same chair you're sitting in when he was in on Monday. And he says that with all the things you say need shoring up in Kansas, that you will wind up being the Bernie Sanders of of Kansas. What do you say to that?
Oh,
he's saying you'll be raising taxes right and left.
Steve, I mean, I think all you need to do is look at the number of very prominent, high-profile, moderate Republicans who are all in on this campaign.
For you?
Yes, for me. You know, you look at Bill Graves and Mike Hayden and Nancy Kassenbaum, Sheila Fromm, you know, go on Dick Bond from around this area.
Right.
Clearly, those folks know me, and they know how I operate, and they know that I am a no-nonsense, common-sense leader who will not take our state to an extreme. They're very confident that I will lead the way I always have in the Senate.
Do you guys agree on anything? Because one thing, again, that's notable about this campaign is that the two of you, at least philosophically, come from such dramatically different places.
You know, there is actually one issue that we agree on, and that would be in the workers' comp, we both believe that we should go back to the fourth edition versus the sixth edition. That's way down in the weeds, but that is one thing that we both
agree.
That's
an issue of import to people who work in that area, but there's not much more, I don't gather.
I don't really think so, no.
I mean, we're really, really talking about Kansas going two very different directions based on how voters render their judgment next week.
I think so. I mean, I think the choice is very, very clear. You know, we can either keep ourselves on this path to recovery, where the legislature put us last year when we overturned the Brownback tax experiment. We need to stay on that road. You know, we're not out of the woods yet, but we can't even stand a bump in the road.
Laura Kelly is my guest. She's a Democratic nominee for Kansas governor. If you have questions for Senator Kelly, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, a lot of people agree that the needs in the state are great, and I wonder how you would go about prioritizing what should get done first. I mean, school funding needs a boost. The state Supreme Court has said as much. The state highway fund has been robbed of tens of millions, hundreds of millions, as you've pointed out. Services for children need bolstering. Gina Meyer-Hummel was just here this week as well, talking about the needs for kids in foster care. The prison system is said to be underfunded. Higher education leaders say the universities need help. It's a lot of stuff coming at the next governor very quickly here.
Oh, yeah, Steve. I mean, the problems are broad and they are deep. Clearly, the first thing that we will do is address the education funding issue. Fortunately, because we did repeal the Brownback tax experiment, we actually have the money in the bank to deal with the inflation factor, and we will take care of that this next session. I think the other area that we've got to focus on is our child welfare system. You know, we really are talking life and death situations there. It's an emergency, and we've been focusing on it. We've got that task force put together. We'll be coming up with final recommendations that will be out in January, and that will receive immediate attention.
We need more social workers. Lots of needs in that area.
Oh, that agency has been just decimated. You know, we don't have social workers at the front end to do the family preservation work. We don't have them at the back end to do reintegration either into the biological family or into an adoptive family. And we've got over 7,000 kids, I think 7,700 kids, stuck in the system. That's not right. We've seen an increase. I think there were 5,000 when Brownback took office, and you know, now over 7,700. Part of that is because of the situation I just described there. Part of it is what we did when we unraveled the safety net for folks. We really pulled that out from underneath some of our most vulnerable families who were no longer able then to sort of keep their family together and take care of their kids. KU did a study that showed a direct correlation between removing that safety net and the number of kids in foster care. So we have got a lot of work to do there, and it is an emergency situation, and we will deal with that out of the box.
You know, do you find that Kansans have a good feel for the extent to which state services were cut during the Brownback years and the kind of havoc that's been caused as a result of all that?
I think in some areas they do. I mean, clearly, you and others have covered the foster care situation, so I think people are pretty well aware of that. I think that schools, clearly, folks understood what had happened to our schools. We saw that in 2016 when so many of those school advocacy groups sort of blossomed and were able to really change the complexion in the legislature and elect more pro-education folks. I think our roads, it's becoming more and more apparent to people that our roads are in bad shape and that you know, we've actually taken $2 billion from our roads. And so, yeah, I think they are. I think there are some places where they don't have and couldn't really understand how deep and broad the damage is.
Let's talk about schools just for a moment. Again, when Chris Kobach was here earlier this week, he made a real point of saying that, he made two points. One, that pouring more money into the system hasn't resulted in test scores going up, and he's concerned about that. And secondly, he's willing to go ahead and abide by the state Supreme Court ruling, perhaps, if the legislature agrees to stick as ensure that as much as 75% of all the school spending goes actually into the classroom. He's concerned about lavish school buildings. He's concerned about the number of administrators. Address that for us.
Well, you know, when Chris talks about 75 cents going into the classroom, you know, he's using funny numbers. The actual amount that's going into the classroom is at least that much now, perhaps more.
Depends on how you calculate it, right?
It does. You know, I mean, he's dismissing, you know, everything like transportation. I mean, we've got to get kids to school in order to get them in the classroom. Food service, just the kinds of support services that make a school able to run, make kids able to learn. So, I think his numbers are just wrong. And the fact of the matter is we have not been pouring money into our schools, and we've actually seen grades go down, test scores go down. We just started refunding our schools this past year. So time will tell, but there have been a number of studies done that shows that it does matter how much money you spend.
Are you concerned that money has been spent on lavish school buildings, as he contends, that too many districts are overloaded with administrators? He threw out some numbers suggesting that the number of administrators has gone up significantly. Is that an issue?
No. Actually, it was a Republican leadership sanctioned study that was done last year that found that Kansas schools are actually some of the most efficiently run in the entire nation. So that argument just doesn't hold water at all. I think when you talk about lavish schools, what folks need to remember is that those dollars are not state general fund dollars. Those are local option budget dollars. Generally, there are bond issues that are put before the public, and they decide whether or not they want to modernize their school buildings. So I don't particularly want to take that ability to decide what they want away from the people.
The other thing you hear sometimes, not just from Kobach, but from members of both parties, is that Western Kansas particularly, there are too many school districts. Some counties, 4, 5, 6 districts inside one rural county. That adds to administrative costs. How big of an issue is that, and what would you do about it?
Well, first of all, there's been an incentive in statute for years for school districts to consider consolidation, and indeed some of them have. What we have seen more of, though, the real cost savings is in sort of joint purchasing, joint administration. And we have seen that even if there's not been an official consolidation, we have seen the sharing of resources among our schools and our rural districts. You know, they haven't had any choice. You know, the funding has just not been there for them to do anything but that. So I think that, that's again, obviously a very sensitive issue for our communities. And I think that, what we're going to do in our administration is set up an Office of Rural Prosperity. We will be filtering all issues, budget and policy through that office. But we're also going to be providing technical assistance to our rural communities so that they can really evaluate what their assets are and what they're not and build on those and make some tough decisions.
But what's a realistic outlook for rural Kansas? You know, I drive through the Flint Hills, try to get out there at least once or twice a year and take a look. And it's amazing to me some of those towns, as wonderful as the Flint Hills are, boy, some of those towns out there are clearly hurting. Main streets boarded up. You see that over and over again. What's realistic? What should rural Kansans expect out of a Kelly administration and what it might mean for them?
Well, rural Kansas has probably been hurt the most by the Brownback experiment. And I think by doing some simple things like funding schools, expanding Medicaid, which would allow for our rural hospitals to continue to operate, is important. And then reinstating our transportation programs. You know, for 30 years, we've had a comprehensive transportation program that has built roads. If we do those kinds of things, our rural communities can prosper. You know, but without those, they can't. So I think the things that we plan to do overall for the state will help our rural communities more than most.
Laura Kelly is my guest. She's a Democratic candidate for Kansas governor. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here. And Rick from Lawrence. Rick, welcome. You're on with Senator Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Go ahead, Rick.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, I'm sorry. My question is, first off, I'm a retired firefighter, and my my wife is a retired school teacher. And for years, money has been stolen from CAPERS. And I'm wondering what our prospective governor thinks about that and what should be done about it.
What can be done about refocusing funding on CAPERS, Senator Kelly?
Yeah, thank you. Well, actually, we are starting to repay the money that we borrowed from CAPERS. You know, we can't actually take money out of CAPERS. That's illegal. So what we have done, though, in the past few years has been not to make the employer's fair share, I think to the tune of about $194 million. So last legislative session, we put back $83 million of that, and then we are scheduled for in the next 2 years to return the rest of it in equal segments, I think $56 million apiece for the next 2 years. That will repay that debt, and then we just need to continue to make our employer's fair share. We actually revised the CAPERS system a few years ago, where we moved away from the defined benefit to a cash balance system. And that will be good for the employees upon retirement. They'll actually get an annuity guaranteed rate. And then it also provides some protection for the employer. So we expect near full solvency of that program by 2033, 2035.
But what can you promise retirees like Rick that you will do in a Kelly administration to ensure funding of CAPERS?
Well, you just present that in your budget and, you know, don't steal it and use it for other things.
And you're not going to steal it.
Well, you know, I think we can make our payments, you know, because it's all because we reversed the Brownback tax experiment. You know, that was why we were having to borrow the money in the first place. So I think the fact that we undid that, put ourselves on the road to recovery, we've seen 16 months now, straight months of revenues coming in over estimates. So I think we're on the right road. And I think it's going to allow us adequate funding to take care of our obligations.
You know, on the stump and in your meeting with the STARS editorial board, you've been pretty clear about expectations, that fixing everything that has occurred in the last administration is not going to happen quickly. Tell us what we might expect.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is we didn't get into this mess overnight, and it's going to take us a lot more than 2 weeks to fix it. So I think we have to – I mean, there's some things emergent that we'll have to do immediately, the schools and foster care. Other things, we will have to lay out priorities and fund as we possibly can. We will do that, but it'll take us years to really to undo the damage that has been done by the Brownback administration.
You know, you pledged recently in Wichita, and I mentioned this at the opening, to bring in a bipartisan administration. What do you have in mind?
Well, Steve, I don't know how else to work other than in a bipartisan fashion. You know, I was actually a math major when I went to college, and so I can count. And when I walked into the Senate, I think the entire time I've been in the Senate, 14 years, have never been more than 10 Democrats. So I immediately went across the aisle and formed relationships that I continue to have to this day. And it's the only way you get things done in the state of Kansas. And so I know it'd be the only way I can get things done as governor is to work in a bipartisan fashion. And I want to put in place in the cabinet and other positions, I want to put the best and the brightest, the most qualified folks, regardless of party affiliation. You know, I just don't have an ideological bone in my body. I'm just really interested in getting the job done, and I need the best people there to do it.
Let's go back to some calls. Let's go to Bill from Leawood. Bill, you're on Up to Date with Laura Kelly. Good morning.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
I'm very good, Bill. It's good to hear you.
I've owned businesses in Olathe and Overland Park since 1994. I was 26 years old when I started my first business. It was an engineering laboratory business, and we supported Black and Veatch and some of the other big engineering firms, Burns and McDonald. I left Kansas on the work side, and my clinic is now over at St. Joseph Medical Center in Missouri because I didn't think I was going to get the support that I needed. When I first moved to Kansas in 94 to start a business, the environment was very friendly. We had a good tax base. We had, and I'm not anti-tax. I'm not pro-tax, but I think there needs to be a balance. But the key thing was the tax was getting used for education, and you were able to attract workers. I had some of the best workers from KU.
And Bill, get if you can get to a question, I don't have a lot of time left.
Yeah, I mean, it's very simple. What are you going to do to attract businesses that need the high intellectual education that we need to compete with the rest of the states? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bill.
Well, Steve, clearly Bill's question goes right to education. You know that, and he's right. I mean, as I said, one of the reasons that my husband and I moved to Kansas was because of the Stellar school system. And I know a lot of folks who have come to Kansas because of that. And that is the way that we attract businesses. That is the way that we attract young people. I mean, Bill was 26 when he started his company. That's exactly the kind of person we need to have in the state of Kansas. So we will be funding our education system. And then I will also be an ambassador for this state. You know, I will be going out and recruiting and presenting the image of Kansas as we will make it. Which is, again, a very common sense quality place to live with a great cost of living.
You know, maybe a couple final points here. Many Democrats believe you've been too weak on gun control, and they point out that you've been endorsed in the past by the NRA in some of your state Senate races. What about that? Where are you today on gun control?
Well, you know, I have been a supporter of the Second Amendment, but it became clear that we went too far in the state of Kansas. And so a couple of years ago, I voted to ban guns on campus. Last year, I voted for a number of amendments that would have put common sense gun policy into place. We were able to take guns out of the hands of people with domestic violence convictions. We were able to keep guns out of our public hospitals, mental health centers, and we need to do some more. And so what I plan to do as governor is just to bring together law enforcement, mental health professionals, public health professionals, educators, students, and parents, and craft a common sense, comprehensive gun policy for the state of Kansas, and then work with the legislature.
Okay. That's State Senator Laura Kelly. She's a Democratic nominee for governor in a very tight race with Chris Kobach. Thanks for sharing your views. Good luck. Travel safe.
It's great to be here, Steve.
You bet.
Thank you.
Again, Senator Laura Kelly. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll switch topics dramatically and talk about the Battle of Antietam. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, the Secretary of the Kansas Department for Children and Families addressed the challenges within the agency and the steps she's taking to improve conditions for both kids and employees. You can listen at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a pre-election political panel with Kansas City reporters and editors who will share their insights on the candidates and the issues. So if you're not prepared for Tuesday, you'll want to be with us for that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Justin Martin is a marvel of an author, a former Kansas City resident. He writes books on topics as connected to each other as oil is to water. He's written about life of Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park, about Walt Whitman, and about Alan Greenspan. Justin Martin's latest book is about another switcheroo. He's back with a compelling account of the Civil War Battle of Antietam, which was the bloodiest day in American history. The book is titled A Fierce Glory, Antietam, the Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. He'll be speaking at the Central Library at 6:30 this evening. That's at 14 West 10th Street. And so good to have you, Justin. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
How did you manage to go from Olmsted to Greenspan to Antietam?
Well, Greenspan,
that's quite a range.
Yeah, Greenspan, I can't claim any kind of connection, but certainly Olmsted. Olmsted actually headed up, although he was best known as a landscape architect, he headed up a medical unit that was present at Antietam. And so Antietam kind of made a cameo in my Olmsted book, and I became interested in the battle. And for my last couple books, I have focused on Civil War era subjects.
So there is some consistency.
There's some consistency.
There's some rationale. There's some something thread. Rational here happening. Yeah. You say this battle was more important than Gettysburg, which was, of course, the better-known battle. Why is that?
Well, this was a battle that everything was at stake. Whoever won was going to win the Civil War, pretty much. There were so many things. I'll just give a couple examples where if the Confederacy had won, it would have tilted the Union midterm elections where the Democrats would have gotten voted in. They would have hobbled Lincoln's – Lincoln was a Republican, of course. They would have hobbled his war agenda. The great European powers like Britain and France were standing by. They said, if the Union loses, we're going to step in and divide this fighting nation into two. And then because the Union won, it was able to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which really sparked the Union war effort and led to the Union victory. So this was a battle where everything was at stake.
This was the most lethal day in American history. Tell us about that. What was the carnage?
Carnage was the official death toll is 3,650 men died that day. Another 2,000 would die from their injuries in the weeks and months that followed the Battle of Antietam. And a lot of what it had to do with, the best way to think of it was you had kind of old-fashioned Napoleonic tactics of men having to stand very close to one another and shoot, and yet the weaponry was too modern for that. So men were standing in long rows 100 yards apart with weaponry that was accurate at that range and further. And because it was fought in a valley, Antietam Valley, you had a lot of instances in which men were pushed just by the topography into very close-range fighting. So old-fashioned close-range fighting done with modern weapons was a formula for a terrible day of carnage.
More soldiers died on this day than the entire Battle of 1812.
That is correct.
Again, perspective here is fascinating to me.
No, that is correct. There are many, many sort of signal events in American history, such as the Battle of Saratoga, major Revolutionary War battle. Fewer than 100 colonial soldiers died in that.
I didn't realize that until I read that either.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. The Alamo, the subject of lore and poems and so forth, just a couple hundred brave Texans died. And so Antietam was kind of on a scale that was just nothing else had prepared that was in a divided country for this terrible scale.
What was it like for a soldier to be in the midst of that tumult that day? Describe it was so much smoke from the firing of the weapons, you couldn't see the enemy at many points.
Very true. No, there's that old phrase, the fog of war, and this was the fog of war in extremis. I mean, there was, from accounts that I read, people said it was just deafening throughout the day. You know, there's the sound of cannon and the pop, pop, pop. You had the sound of cannon, which was just deafening. You had the pop, pop, pop of muskets. Some people describe that as the musket fire was so intense that it sounded like a piece of canvas being torn. It was just a sort of that popping. You had the whinnies, a very discernible sound that a lot of soldiers report on was the whinnies of horses being shot, falling. Then, of course, you had the screams and yells of men. Then, of course, you had the acrid smoke that had this ingredient called saltpeter that actually kind of burned your lungs. You also had the fact that it was an unseasonably warm day in September. It was September 17th of 1862. The temperature rose to about 70. So the men were hot in their heavy uniforms, had, you know, just the sound surrounding them, the smoke surrounding them, and just a very chaotic, tumultuous day.
You can't help but wonder, you mentioned a minute ago about the way war was engaged back in those days. Why did they still fight that way, sort of face to face, 100 yards apart? What were they thinking?
What they were thinking was it's what they learned at West Point for most of the generals. And it also, many of the generals had an idea that battle was kind of, it was almost like a gentlemanly. So you position your men, you open fire. So there's a kind of a formality to it. And some of the different types of warfare that have come subsequently, guerrilla warfare, everything from guerrilla warfare to what you might call remote warfare, where people send in drones and don't even have any intimacy with their target. In this era, there was a sense too when the war started that maybe the war would be fought almost like a grand scale duel. Lines of men would stand and shoot each other, and ultimately on the battlefield, not in the towns, not in the cities of the north or south, but on the battlefield it would be determined.
Justin Martin is my guest. His new book is titled A Fierce Glory, Antietam, the Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. Again, he's speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street, downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. You say in the title of this book, Justin, that this was a desperate battle. And I imagine all battles are desperate to one degree or another, but what made this one so particularly desperate?
What made this so particularly desperate was this was um, the the Confederates had been intending to fight a big battle in Maryland, and the Union had been kind of pursuing them. And so there was a lot of kind of lead up to it. You can think of it almost like a chess match. The Confederates are moving through the state. The Union's pursuing them. And when they finally confront each other and were sort of forced to confront each other at the sort of the tail end of this chess game, they're in this tightly confined valley. And so kind of the lead up, I feel like the lead up, the tension, the sense that this big battle was coming, and then the fact that when the big battle happened, it happened in such a confined, constrained area, led to a desperate contest.
You know, why this place? Why this time? What was it about Maryland that the Confederates were aiming at there?
The Confederates had a lot of notions, including they hoped to flip Maryland, as it were. Maryland was a what was called a border state. It was a state that had stayed in the Union, but with slavery intact. There are other border states such as Missouri and Kentucky. And so part of what the Confederates were thinking is win a battle on Maryland soil where there's a lot of pent-up Confederate sympathy. Maybe they can get Maryland to flip from the Union to the Confederacy, enlarge the Confederacy, enlarge their chances of winning the war. So that was why it was fought there. And why it was fought in the particular part of Maryland it was because General Robert E. Lee, the commander of the Confederate forces, he decided that if he could fight a battle close to the Potomac River, which made the border between Maryland and what was then Virginia, if the battle went badly, he had a kind of exit plan, which was to just back up a mile and cross the Potomac back into the safety of rebel Virginia. So it's fought where it was fought because it allowed him to fight a battle on Union soil. Yet if things went wrong, he could quickly retreat into Confederate territory.
Now, this book is interesting, and maybe what distinguishes it from other books on Antietam is this idea that you focus more heavily on Lincoln and his role here and what he was thinking and what he was doing. He had a couple of aces in his pocket he's holding during this time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, his big ace was the Emancipation Proclamation. It was sitting in his desk at the White House. He tinkered with it periodically. It was known only to a few of his closest advisors and cabinet members. And he recognized that this shifting the war effort from being a reunification of the Union to being about emancipating the slaves could really fire up the Union war effort. But it was very necessary to have a Union victory to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. You have the Confederates beat you on Union soil. You look kind of desperate and weak to say to then issue this bold proclamation. So he had this ace, as you described it, waiting. But it also was dependent on there being a positive outcome for the Union.
How would he get updates on what was happening out far from where he was? And what wasn't that far, but for distant place from where he was in the capital.
One of the things that really fascinated me in my research is he was 55 miles away, just 55 miles away. But in the pre-CNN era, he had a great deal of trouble getting news. He wanted desperately. In fact, the interesting thing was he woke up that day. He knew that a big battle was shaping up. He knew that the Union was pursuing the Confederates, but he did not know whether the battle had been fought yesterday, that day, or maybe it would be fought tomorrow.
God, you can hardly imagine that.
And then incredible, today. He did not know. He was desperate for news from his general, McClellan, who could telegraph him at any moment and let him know what was happening. But McClellan was very stingy with information because—
Didn't like Lincoln.
He didn't like Lincoln. They were at cross purposes politically and personally. And so McClellan actually chose to kind of withhold information. And late in the day, he finally sent a telegram that he knew would reach Lincoln in Washington. And the telegram was very vague. It said something like, we're in the biggest battle perhaps of history. Things look positive, but they could go wrong. It's like, what is Lincoln to do with that piece of vague information?
So, when did he finally get a sense of it? What had happened?
He finally got a sense the next day. And the fascinating thing is a reporter for the New York Tribune had written a very good account of the battle, and he was sending it back to his newspaper. And in those days, telegrams, they often got routed from one place to another. So it got routed through Baltimore, and the Baltimore telegram operator recognized, he knew that in Washington, in official Washington, the Secretary of War and Lincoln and so forth were desperate for news. So he took the article and routed it straight to Lincoln as opposed to sending it to the New York Tribune where it was aimed. And so Lincoln's very first account was a press account that was meant to go to New York City that was routed instead to D.C.
Where would he go to get his information?
What Lincoln would do is all day long, Lincoln would go next door to the War Department, which was catty-corner to the White House, and just in a state of high anxiety and high dudgeon, Lincoln would make this five-minute walk throughout the day and see if any new telegrams had arrived. He did that the day of Antietam, and he did that many other days during the Civil War.
Desperate by himself, so eager to know the future, so much in the balance, and grasping for information. It's such an interesting idea for a president of the United States.
No, it's kind of incredible. He would walk over there, and he knew the men in the telegram office very well. And he'd go over there, and he'd say, you know, anything new, any new telegrams to look at. It was he would sometimes, according to accounts I read, make that 5 minute walk, you know, 10, 15, 20 times a day if he thought something big was happening elsewhere.
What did this battle ultimately turn on? The Battle of Antietam, which is what we're talking about here.
What it ultimately turned on was just, I would say it turned on exhaustion. I mean, that was what really, I mean, these were, you know, men having to fire off 40 or 50 shots. That's how many you might get in the course of a day with your musket every time, kicking your shoulder till it was black or blue. As we described earlier, all the chaos, everything. It was at the end of that day. I mean, the battle was a 12-hour battle fought from sunrise to sunset, and it was a tactical draw in the end, although because the Confederates withdrew into Virginia, from an optics standpoint, it was a Union victory. It's a tactical draw, and what really brought that battle to an end was just the sheer exhaustion of the men who were fighting in it, having to deal with that much sound and chaos and danger and adrenaline for 12 straight hours.
What was Robert E. Lee's sort of reflection on the battle? What did he say about it later?
Robert E. Lee felt like, he recognized it as a missed opportunity. He was always a very aggressive general. Mm-hmm. He was well aware that this was, you know, he'd been bested, I guess you could say, in Maryland. He viewed it as a missed opportunity, a lost opportunity. It's interesting because he kind of tried the same thing only about 9 months later, another invasion of the North with many similar elements to it going into Gettysburg. I'd say he felt like it was a missed opportunity. But, he was such an aggressive general that the fact that he withdrew across the Potomac River, it meant a lot. He was the kind of guy who'd stay and fight unless his army was in such poor shape.
I was going to say, why did he withdraw?
He withdrew because he recognized that he actually started the day of the Battle of Antietam with 30,000 men versus the Union with 55,000. Even for having that many fewer men, Lee was so aggressive and so enterprising as a general that his 30,000 easily, it was well within the realm of possibility they could have defeated the Union forces just because Lee was such a clever commander. By the end of that day, he was down many from that 30,000. He recognized he was just, he didn't have enough men to continue the fight.
I was so struck. Some of the men who fought there spent the rest of their lives trying to understand what happened that day. You begin the book by talking about a Union soldier named John Meade Gould, who spent a single day at Antietam. Tell us about him and how he spent the rest of his life looking at this battle.
Sure. Gould grew up in Portland, Maine. He was a bank clerk as an adult before he got called into Civil War service. He fought in Antietam, and he fought all the way through the end of the Civil War, all the way to 1865. Then he returned to Portland to his bank teller job, lived for the entire rest of his life at the same house on Pearl Street where he grew up as a boy, got promoted once in his bank, but he spent the whole rest of his life thinking about his time on the battlefield in Antietam. He wrote letters at first to his Union cohorts, but later on he started writing to Confederates who he'd faced off against as kind of the tensions started to ease.
And they were more forthcoming with what had happened that day than maybe some of the Union guys
were. They certainly were. He found them, as he described, that the Confederates were the better correspondents. He would write them letters. He'd say, you know, as I said, once the tensions kind of started to ease, he'd say, hey, I understand my Maine boys faced your Georgia boys back in 1862. How do you remember what happened that day? And he got to the point where he started visiting Antietam battlefield and walking over the battlefield sometimes with graying old Confederates. They'd walk together and discuss, you know, I think this happened in front of a cottonwood tree or what have you.
Justin Martin's new book, A Fierce Glory, Antietam, the Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. The battlefield still in great shape today if you want to go visit it. Again, Justin speaks tonight at 6:30, 14 West 10th Street, the Central Library. Thanks so much for a good conversation.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do on the weekend. And one cool thing is Leonard Skinner. They're still around.
They are still around.
Yeah.
Leonard Skinner.
Despite tragedy in the past.
Yes, yes. We'll get to that. Yeah. Actually, it's tied into their two-year Last of the Street Survivors farewell tour. We get an installment of that Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Sprint Center downtown. Here's the boil down. On the band's, the tragic history centers on 3 days after the release of Leonard Skinner's 1977 Street Survivors album, which pictured the band on the cover in flames. Remember
wow,
that?
I do.
Okay, so what happens is a few days after that album comes out, the band's on a chartered plane. It crashes in Mississippi. Yeah. It kills six on board. It's a tragedy. And the death toll included the band's lead singer and the lead guitarist. And so the record company scurried to switch the Street Survivors Flaming album cover to something a bit more docile.
Yeah.
So that actually, that original album cover is a collector's item, but you can have a collector's item of your own if you go to the show at 7 o'clock on Friday, because it is indeed the last of the Street Survivors farewell tour, because the last survivor of the band, at least the one on stage we're going to see Friday at Sprint Center, is guitarist Gary Rossington, and he's the lone original Leonard Skinner. Say Leonard Skinner.
Leonard Skinner.
Yeah, that's why you're the host.
Yeah.
Anyway, it should be great. Give me three steps. What's your name? Sweet Home Alabama. Say it with me. Freebird.
Freebird.
Freebird. Don't hold up your phones. Go old school and flick your bicks Friday at Sprint Center.
What do we have here?
Sound of that?
Huh? I do.
Okay,
yeah.
That's actually the sound of Ultimate Fake Book. Ah. They came out of Manhattan, Kansas in the late 90s, and they are actually going to be on stage at Saturday night at the Uptown Theater. They're part of Jason Sudeikis and Friends presenting Thunder Gong.
Wow.
It's the music and comedy show benefiting people who've had some of their limbs amputated, and that's a very good cause to help those people out. So in addition to Jason, we've got, get this, ready?
Yeah.
Chance the Rapper.
Oh, wow.
Big deal.
Yeah.
He's the tip. He's fantastic, right? But I mean, Ultimate Fake Book will be a kind of a nice throwback for a lot of local fans who remember that power pop band of long ago and far away. Another guest will be Will Forte.
Wow.
Who's another SNL alum. 8 o'clock Saturday night, Uptown Theater. Good show, good cause.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 hot things to do in Kansas City this weekend. You'll find it at kcur.org. If only I could have a puppet, I'd call myself so very lucky. Just to have some company, to share a cup of tea with me, I'd take my puppy everywhere. What are we doing here?
We're going to
puppies
have fun with puppies.
I like puppies. Not kitties, puppies.
I know, it's well-established prejudice.
Let's be clear.
You're not too
it's not
happy.
Prejudice, it's just reality.
Oh, no, it's a prejudgment on
no,
all
it's
levels.
Not. No, it's
really?
It's just the way the world is.
So you like Bow Wow more than Meow?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, I'm...
Meow doesn't get you anywhere, but Bow Wow, you're rolling.
Well, ponder that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, it's the Great Kansas City Pet Expo. And everything you could possibly think of that you might need for your puppy or your kitty, or even your pot-bellied pig, or even your mini donkey. Do you realize there's
why would you have a pot-bellied pig? Why do people do that?
That sounds like
a good show.
Sounds like, exactly.
Why do you do that?
Well, they're very smart. You know, pigs are very smart. But mini donkeys are kind of the thing now, where instead of
smart?
A large instead of a large dog, you know, a big dog, you get a little mini donkey. Anyway, yeah. 10 to 6 Saturday, 10 to 4 Sunday, Overland Park Convention Center. Ages 5 and younger free, so the little puppies in the family get in free, the human ones, yeah. A reverend woman with a worried mind. No one in front of me and nothing behind. Sitting on a strange man's lap, drinking champagne. He's got light skin and an assassin's eye.
I'm looking up into a self-tinted sky.
If you haven't seen Betty, you need to go see her.
Yeah.
I've seen her more than once, and each time is memorable.
Yeah. Betty LeVette.
Betty LeVette.
Veteran soul songstress.
I like listening to Betty LeVette.
Oh, 8 o'clock tonight. 8 o'clock tonight, Knucklehead Saloon. She's out promoting a new album. I mean, she's been around since the early 60s doing her soul music thing, but she has a new album out. It is actually the title track of this album, Things Have Changed. She does all these Bob Dylan tunes, so you're going to get some Bob Dylan, like this one, where she's sitting on a strange man's lap sipping champagne. What great lyrics by Bob Dylan. You'll get The Times They Are a-Changin'. I bet you get It Ain't Me,
She
Babe.
Reaches inside and rearranges things.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, that's what she does.
Sometimes you've got to rebake it, Steve, to make it. And she takes familiar stuff and turns it into new, wonderful stuff.
And finally today... What are we doing here?
Well, that sounds like a crescendo to me.
Yes, it does.
And it's time for the UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance Crescendo Event.
Very cool event.
Very cool event.
I'm going.
Oh, that's
I'll
wonderful.
Be there.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Can you handle it? Is my question.
It's fun.
Okay, it's the Student Showcase and Fundraiser.
Yes, it is.
It kicks off with cocktails at 5:30, dinner at 6:30, then the 8 o'clock concert at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts downtown. And you will get jazz, you will get opera, you will get classical music, you will get dance, and you'll get it from, get this, in a one-hour show, 250 UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance students and faculty doing their thing in a single one-hour time frame.
It moves fast, and it will leave you slack-jawed.
Like me right now.
Like right now.
Oh, my gosh.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Have fun.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow marks the final countdown to Tuesday's election. We'll take one last look at candidates, issues, and ballot measures here on KCUR's Up to Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.